Good evening. My name is Sanam Anderlini. I'm here tonight with three hats, roughly speaking. I'm the founder and CEO of the International Civil Society Action Network that spearheads the Women's Alliance for Security Leadership. Some of our members are here, and they're members of the second hat that I'm wearing tonight, which is the Commonwealth Women's Mediators Network. And many of you are in the room. Would you just put your hands up, those of you who are members? These are the most awesome superheroes that we have around the world in the Commonwealth, so do get a chance to talk to them. And then finally, a new hat that I will be wearing as of December 1st, which is part-time director as of the Center for Women, Peace, and Security here at LSE. So this is kind of a fun evening to start, yeah. So, thank you very much. But I'm really, really thrilled to be here tonight with four of my colleagues who truly are wonderful, incredible, courageous women. And we're going to have a conversation this evening about their role as mediators, as peace builders, in some of the most intractable and difficult contexts around the world right now. And it will be a conversation. You might see some slides, but it's going to be a fairly informal setting, and we will open it up to the floor for questions and comments at about 45 minutes so that you also get to participate and we hear from the floor as well. So with that, I'm going to open and introduce my first colleague, who is Isabir Ali, who is from Jammu and Kashmir, with over two decades of work in psychosocial healing and economic development for women, and establishing safe and inclusive spaces across the three states of Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh. Over the many decades, 47 years of conflict that has been intractable, it has been frozen, now it's become hot, and I'm not sure exactly what. So we're going to hear from you. And what I would love to know is for you to explain to us, what is it that you do in that context? And what is it that you feel you've managed to achieve as a mediator and as a peace builder? And just for the record, we are on record. It's being podcast, and there will be pictures taken. If you don't want your picture taken or on a film, please put your hand up so that the photographer can see if anybody's worried about their face being shown. Everybody's okay? Okay. Thank you very much. So, Isabir, the floor over to you. Thank you. Yeah? Yeah.
Good evening, everyone. All right. Let me share about the kind of work that I've been doing in Kashmir. It revolves around doing peace building, mediation. Peace building and mediation is a very, has a thin line of margin from the context I come from. And I think what I'm going to share with you today may explain why there is a very thin line. Kindly take a note of these pictures that I'm showing right now. This picture is the picture of, you have ulemas standing in this, and what they're holding in their hand is a statement, a consensus statement, in which they have, after a series of interactions, they have come together and decided on a period of wait that a half widow needs to go through before she can think of remarriage. The picture is very important in context of what I'm going to share next. Please remember this picture as well. There is a lot of difference between the first one and the second one, and I hope to get some observations from you all on that. The history of armed conflict in Jammu and Kashmir dates back to 1947, when the subcontinent got divided into India and Pakistan on religious lines. Kashmiris were promised plebiscite, which never took place. In 1989, a liberation movement started in the state, which spiraled into a low-level militancy, and it led to a cycle of armed violence, conflict, and civilian populations were caught between two warring fighting parties. Can see a small child with a toy gun. It's very reflective of the situation that happened there. The impact of the conflict was that it has consumed more than 100,000 lives. 8,000 to 10,000 people have been subject to enforced disappearances. The figures have been taken from APDP, Association for Parents of Disappeared Persons source, whereas the official view is some custodial crimes have taken place, but these are very few and in between, far between. So what these disappearances resulted in was a group of women known as half-widows. So who is a half-widow? A half-widow is a woman whose husband has been subjected to involuntary enforced disappearances and his whereabouts remain unverifiable. This is a typical case of a half-widow, Rafika, wife of Mushtaq Khan. Her husband disappeared on 13th April 1997. The main problems that she has been going through are she has been denied property rights by the in-laws. She's living alone with her only son. She has multiple health issues. She's fighting for sustenance and education of her son. She needs counseling and psychosocial support. Most of these disappearances that have taken place happened in rural areas where women were generally very illiterate, as such economically reliant. Their problems range from socioeconomic and emotional front. They don't get compensation from the government because the government demands death certificate, which obviously they cannot for a missing person. There are no unambiguous legal and administrative remedies available to half-widows. So for that, they have to struggle for survival, and they are fighting the social, cultural, and norms. They have been forced by circumstances to assume the role of bread earners for survival of their family. They continue to live a life of endless wait. I did a small study in 2013 on the psychological impact of the conflict on the lives of these women. And some of the findings I'm sharing with you. Most of these women are going through emotional stress, harassment, social problems. They face loneliness, physical insecurity, overburden of work. They are always living under the threat of losing home and property, and they are dependent for living. A very serious thing that came to light was that most of them, over 85%, admitted to having the prevalence of suicide ideation, and over 85% felt like killing others. So what about these rights of these half-widows that we are talking about? You know, there was no consensus on the issue of remarriage of a half-widow. That means for how many years is this lady required to wait before she can think of remarriage? Because her husband's whereabouts remain unknown. So we have different sects, Muslim sects, the Hanfi, the Shafi, the Malki, and all of them had different number of years that they were propagating, ranging from 4 to 7 to 9 to 90. So what is this lady supposed to do? Most of the time they have 3 or 4 children. So under the banner of SRs and with support of conciliation resources, we deliberated on the problems, particularly during related to the waiting period of these half-widows. So this was the first initiative by any group of civil society in Kashmir. We engaged with religious leaders, prominent members of civil society, representatives of Association of Parents of Disappeared Persons, as well as half-widows. We were trying to confabulate on what best could be done to address this critical issue confronting this helpless lot in the society. We tried to create a public opinion. We tried to build awareness amongst the general masses about the problems and plight of these ladies. So we did a series of articles. We published series of stories related to these so that public opinion is built. These are some of the ulamas belonging to different sects who were part of these deliberations. Gradually, as you see, that some women have also started entering the scene, and you can see a representation of women during these talks. Earlier, it was generally male-dominated. So you have half-widows sitting and speaking to the ulemas. You have members of civil society, which comprised of women representatives, who were sitting in these tables and speaking to the ulemas. The percentage, the representation of women started growing as we kept engaging with these ulemas. This photograph is very important because on 3rd August 2013, this group of ulema, after a series of deliberations and dialogue and mediations that we held with them, came up with a consensus statement where they said that a half-widow can remarry after a period of 4 years after the disappearance of her husband, and the issue of property would be dealt with in light of the teachings of Islam and religion. And this was a big leap forward. So we publicized it. We put it in all the local newspapers, so the women come to know about it. The half-widows are aware that this kind of a statement has been taken. There's no ambiguity surrounding their waiting period from 9. It has come down to 4. So in this picture, you have the ulema who are, displaying the consensus statement. The challenges while dealing with this were many. There was ignorance and non-involvement of religious and social bodies, which aggravated the tragedies of these half-widows. It was a highly sensitive topic, as it was about interpreting religion. And we did not want to be seen as those interfering with Sharia or religion. So we had to tread our paths very carefully. There was insensitiveness of in-laws, which had deprived them of the property rights, and most of them had found themselves thrown out of their homes. And these women were seen as symbol of or representatives of the scars of conflict, and so was being perceived by some. So this kind of an intervention was also in some ways being perceived as, a threat by some, that probably we should not find ways for these women to move forward. This picture is very important. If you may recollect the earlier picture that I had shown about the ulemas with the consensus statement, and this is where we had actually come to after a series of interactions and having spent many years in, having dialogue and active listening, using those as a tool, where the ulema you find are standing and the women have been given the seat. So it was a big leap forward about their attitude and style and, about their treatment of women. The second picture that I had displayed in the PowerPoint presentation earlier was, in the earlier picture you had only men who were representational of the society, who were trying to display the consensus statement. And here in this picture, which was in 2019, just recently, a few months back, where we have ulama as well as women, and I think there are more women than ulama in this, and we are displaying and releasing the nikahnama for women, where the rights of women have been defined in a marriage. Nikahnama is a marriage contract. And usually what happens is in most of the nikahnamas, you only have the amount of dower mentioned, and you don't mention the rights of the women, you don't emphasize on their roles and responsibilities, as a result of which, because of this gap, we felt that many women were suffering. So we came up with the model nikahnama, and in this picture we are releasing that. So you can see women as well as men, both are participating. This I find is the crux or the theme of my journey as a peace builder and mediator from that picture to here. So this actually, covers the journey that I have been spending from 2013 covering this. So while these can be quoted, thank you. So while these can be quoted as examples of women's struggle in Kashmir, what it means to be a mediator and a peace builder, to continue living despite all odds and can be seen in a positive light. The violent and political dubious realities cannot be negated. The question remains, can anything be done to elevate the problems of these directly affected women and enhance their broadening role in the society in face of dire circumstances?
Thank you. Thank you. So from Kashmir to Sierra Leone, Barbara Bangua, you've been a peace activist for 20 years. You established the women's NGO called Grassroots Empowerment for Self-Reliance. You've also been active in the elections and elections observations and situation rooms across Africa, so from in Kenya and in, and elsewhere over the last few years. If we go back to Sierra Leone, and I don't know how many of you remember or have studied the Sierra Leone conflict, but in the 1990s, it was one of the most horrific settings in terms of people's children having their limbs chopped off, women being raped, crack cocaine being put into the foreheads of young people. It was truly, truly, it was extreme violence long before the world was even aware of these things. What were you, when you think back in terms of peace activism, are there moments where you say, this is what we did and this is what we achieved? What is it that stays with you in terms of your decades of experience?
One of the things that always comes to mind is the resilience of our community women. Not because they're strong, but because they have to survive. Their families have to survive. I started my organization because, it was like the name said, to empower community women economically, particularly depressed communities. So we got funding, went in, and we realized we couldn't do anything because the war was over, but you now had community members who'd been rebels coming back into the community, collaborators, people who were seen as collaborators, and survivors of rape. So we had to intervene, we had to provide counseling, but more important, I became a mediator by accident, by default. But we were able to move ahead with it, and were able to train women, community women, with basic mediation skills, and we carried on. But one of the things that, one story where I actually mediated in was in the north of Sierra Leone, where we were trying to reintegrate ex-combatants into the community, and the community said no. They're not welcome, they cannot come back, because they did a lot of bad things that were seen as sacrilegious. They brought the rebels into the town, like to score points against people that they were that were seen as enemies or they'd had problems with. Women were raped. A lot of bad things happened in Sierra Leone. And so we had to do a lot of dialogue, talking. We had to actually bring in people to do counseling for particularly the ex-combatants. And we also, what I found very interesting was we had the traditional leaders, the paramount chiefs, but at the end we realized they weren't they didn't have the power. It was the African leaders. In Africa we call them like fictitious, you know, like black magic. They were the ones with the power. They were the ones who guided the traditional leaders on what to do. So we had to really work on them. But I'm happy to say at the end of the day, they were accepted back. And what stands out for me is that there wasn't any agreement signed, but they used the traditional cleansing processes. The African leaders washed these ex-combatants by the river. A lot of food was cooked. A sheep was killed. A lot of food was cooked. And that was seen as a sacrifice, and a cleansing and healing process. So this happened like at least 16, 17 years ago, but it still is fresh in my mind. We do a lot of work, I've done a lot of work, and I still work on elections-related violence, and that for me is the most threatening in terms of my personal security. And we still don't have the answer on how to ensure that we're safe. So we just go into it headlong and do the best we can.
I'll come back to the threat question, actually, a little bit later. I'm going to now turn to, thank you very much. That was, and actually, just before I, you have these cleansing processes for these young men and boys, yes, who would perpetrated unbelievable violence. Yeah. Some of them had themselves been kidnapped and forced into this.
Yes.
So they're victims,
yes,
perpetrators.
Yeah.
And then the communities were willing to accept them back?
After after a lot of negotiation, after a lot of talk, I think that what was difficult for them was, like, you have some of them raped sisters, you know, family members. And that was some of the things that were considered a sacrilege. But it was a continuous process. Even though they accepted them back, there was a lot of counseling, even for the women and other community members.
Thank you.
So it was a process.
It's interesting because, you know, we think about that happening in Sierra Leone 17, 20 years ago. But in a sense, this idea of returning people who have done horrible things back into their own society, back into their own community, is very much very prevalent in England and in Europe and in the Western world right now with all the ISIS and other fighters, right? And you know, and this idea that we're going to strip them of their citizenship and let them roam the world, you guys took them back and took responsibility. Yeah. So it's important to learn from that experience. Thank you. I'm going to turn to the other part of the world. And to Rose Pihai. Rose, you're from Bougainville. You've been active, again, for many years in the context of Bougainville, and you've been in the political space as the one female minister in the Bougainville Executive Council. Tell us a little bit about the Bougainville context, the conflict, and what you've been doing as a peace builder, but also in the political space. Thank you.
Thank you. Bougainville is a province within Papua New Guinea. And it's a province that has gone to war because of unequal distribution of natural resources, and the political independence agenda by the Bougainville leaders, starting way back in the 1960s. So. In 1988-89, a war broke out because the agreement, Bougainville Copper Agreement, was not reviewed in two consecutive terms, seven-year term. So in 14 years, the agreement was not reviewed, and so a war broke out in 1988-89. The war claimed more than 20,000 lives in a space.
In a population of
just over 300,000, and now it's 400,000. So by the end of the 10-year conflict, more than 20,000 lives were claimed by the war, and so. For Bougainville, a peaceful region, to go into a war was something that Bougainvillians never expected. Some of us experienced the war in different situations. My family were political prisoners. And we went under house arrest for 18 months. So because of the experience that we have had during the war, Bougainville women have decided, for some of us leaders have decided that we don't want another war to happen in Bougainville. So that's why we, out of our own initiative, we have come out to become peace builders, even without training, formal training. We have just decided to do what we can for the love of our people. So today, in 2001, there was a peace agreement that was signed, and according to ratings, Bougainville Peace Agreement is one of the few successful peace agreements in the world. So there was a 10 to 15 years window of opportunities for Bougainville to prepare for a referendum for independence. The Bougainville Peace Agreement had three pillars. One was the first one was autonomy, the second one was weapons disposal, and the third one was the referendum for independence. So the all the pillars have now being fulfilled. Now we are in the final pillar now, which is the referendum for independence. So as I speak, today Bougainville is conducting a referendum for independence now. So we started voting on Saturday, and today was the second day of voting. Preparations for the referendum were very successful. In the lead up of the time frame of the referendum, everyone just joined in and just made sure that referendum preparedness was successful, so that a free and fair referendum vote was guaranteed. So some of the impacts of the war are generational trauma, and these are some of the issues that we are dealing with now. And there are small pockets of Bougainville groups that are still not being able to really come out clear and become part of the peace process. So this is where I'm engaged in currently with mediation work and the peace building work. So currently I'm doing mediation work and peace building work in a group that did not join the peace process from 2001 when the peace agreement was signed. So far we have been successful in making sure that they became part of the process, and some of them will be voting for the first time in the referendum vote this time. They haven't voted in any election before the referendum vote, so this is the first time they would be voting, and this is a success story of some of the work that I'm doing with a few women in peace building in Bougainville, because it's such a small place, it doesn't need hundreds of women to just put their hearts together and do the work that we are doing. A post-conflict situation that took 6 years, only took five committed women to broker peace with the warring parties. Even without financial support, or even without resources, whatever it might be, it took five women wholly committed to the cause to bring peace for the whole Bougainville community. So to me, that's something where I find in women who are committed to peace building, it just takes a heart. It takes a heart to pursue peace, or pursue peace building or peace processes, to actually contribute and participate in peace building work, which contributes to nation building. The way to understand peace building is that there's a level, there's that national level that decisions are made. But there's that grassroots level that is really, really important, because that's where if decisions are made up here and you can't contain the community, that's where the violence will break out. So if leaders are not making the right decisions, and if we can contain the groups in the communities, then there is guarantee that peace will stability will still continue to maintain itself, because of the fact that the communities realize the importance of maintaining the stability that we have in Bougainville now. I think that's where we are. But the threat now that I see is the generational trauma that no one has really taken into account, which only peace builders are trying to work on, and that's where civil society comes in to deal with the trauma issues of conflicts. And I think this is the most important part of peace building in Bougainville, where even though governments are busy making sure that the roadmap for the next leg of our achievement, which is the post-referendum process. Civil society is continue to concentrate on building the capacity of the civil society people and the community at large. So it's like we are concentrating not only on the regional level, but on the grassroots level as well. So Bougainville has had two unilateral declarations of independence. Both of them were unsuccessful, so this is the final attempt now Bougainville is going through to gain its aspirations by voting for two options. There's two options in the ballot paper. The first option is great autonomy, under the great autonomy, we will negotiate some more powers which we don't have under the current autonomy arrangement. And if the decision goes for independence, then it's a complete cut off from the rest of Papua New Guinea. So these are the options that we are voting for, and this will involve a lot of work in the post referendum period. Already we are working and planning for the post-referendum period. And I think one thing I want to mention here is Bougainville, as when I was a minister, I initiated a national action plan on women, peace, and security. And the framework is being implemented not the way we would like it to be implemented, but one of the roles that the steering committee is doing now is advocating for inclusion of women in the high-level committees that will be negotiating the way forward for the transition period for post-referendum. The success stories for the advocacy is now we have two women represented at the joint ministerial planning task force, which is a task force that the two governments sit to negotiate and prepare for the post-referendum roadmaps. Because the Bougainville Peace Agreement is not binding, it will be negotiated between the two governments. So some of the mechanism for the ratification process is now being prepared, and in the next meeting, fortunately, the women saw my leadership, and they have included me in the joint ministerial task force. So I'm one of the members in the task force, plus the president for the Bougainville Women's Federation. So that's what the women are doing through the Women, Peace, and Security framework. And we are hoping to continue to advocate for more inclusion in all the committees that will be coming up in the post-referendum transition period.
Thank you. That's amazing. Thank you. That's nice. We're gonna send the five women of Bougainville to Yemen, I think, and get things sorted out there. Yeah. Last but definitely not least, and definitely not any less complicated, Esther Amam Joma from Cameroon. Your conflict is going on as we speak, right? It's been a relatively recent outbreak with some pretty horrific things going on. But women, and you've been one of the women leaders that has been really active in bringing the voices of women into the space of mediation and peace building. Tell us what's going on there.
Thank you, Madam the Chair, for giving me this opportunity to
also talk about the recent conflicts which we are witnessing in the two Anglophone regions of Cameroon. And I wish to say that there has been so much pains and sufferings going on as a result of what started as a corporate claim of common law lawyers and teachers of the Anglophone subsystem of education, meaning that our court, Cameroon, is made up of 10 regions and two speak English and the rest are French speaking. But the courts of the English speaking regions were flooded with French speaking lawyers who do not understand what the common law is. And our schools were flooded with teachers from French speaking regions who were teaching children in a kind of English, which is a mixture of French and some language which the children could not understand. And the English speaking people felt that they've been marginalized a lot for several years. And the distribution, there was unequal distribution of natural resources. So they came out on the street for peaceful demonstrations and they met with stiff resistance from the military who could not allow them to peacefully carry out their demonstrations. They were brutalized, they were arrested, they were maimed. Same with teachers. And later on we had youth who went into the street and started protesting with peace plant. We have a green type of plant in our country, which is called the peace plant. And several youth were killed. And as a result of that, we had people who proclaimed themselves as leaders of the Anglophone movements who were arrested in Nigeria. And this is called today the Naira 10, because there were 10 of those leaders who were arrested in Nigeria. And after the arrest of these 10 leaders, those in the diaspora seized the opportunity and took over with arms. And that is how we got into armed conflict, which today is considered a civil war in my country, whereby over 500,000 people have been displaced, over 50,000 living in Nigeria as refugees. We have over 2,000 people who have been killed and over 206 villages which have been destroyed. And amidst all of this, women and children are the ones who suffered the most, because many men, youths, women, and children have been killed, maimed, raped, kidnapped. Women could no longer go to the farms, knowing very well that the people of those two regions solely rely, mostly rely on the produce from the farms. Livelihoods had been destroyed. There was no access to markets. And as a result of this, nobody said anything. Nobody thought about the women. And the women, they themselves were helpless. They didn't know what to do. The children were being killed randomly. And nobody there raised their voices. So, I started individually to meet authorities in one of my regions, suggesting, proposing to them some way out. especially when the children were refused access to school, were denied education. I told the administrative authorities what I thought could be the solution, but they didn't listen, and they told me that the elites have abandoned them. So nobody cared about the women. In our tradition, in the country where I come from, women do not dig the graves. Men do. But because of the many atrocities committed and the many killings that were going on, women in the villages no longer had people who could dig the grave. So we saw women resorting in digging the grave. This I'm talking about an issue, a crisis we began in October 2016 and went into a full-fledged-blown crisis in January 2018. And these women became helpless. Who will help? So the situation deteriorated a lot, and there was need for immediate action. And I sat, and I remember the past, where we had a conflict. Cameroon had a conflict with Nigeria in Bakassi Peninsula. And this we could easily contain because we supported the government and the military in containing that and making sure that women's voices were heard. But this was different because this is a conflict whereby brothers are killing brothers. It's a conflict between two brothers, you know, and nobody was doing anything. So I had that vision of making sure that women's voices are heard and that women could break the silence and be heard. So I invited four female leaders in my office, and I told them, this is the situation, we cannot allow this to continue. And so this is what I think we should do. And they bought the idea, and they said, this is very good, let us start. And that is how we came up with the name Southwest and Northwest Women Task Force, abbreviated SNOT. On the 5th of May 2018, SNOT was created in my office, and immediately we made a WhatsApp group. We sent the goal out. After formulating the goal, we started recruiting women from the two English-speaking regions, women leaders. And so when we had a good number, like 150, we decided to go physical. So we started meeting and we planned. And I told them that we should be strategic. The first thing we will do to draw attention is humanitarian assistance. Let us go into humanitarian response because we have huge numbers of displacement, huge numbers of displacement. And women and children are the ones suffering. They are the ones hungry. And if we do not do anything, an angry man, a hungry man, is an angry person. And this will lead into other forms of conflict. So we launched the humanitarian response. We, the women, launched the humanitarian response. After launching it in my organization, we launched it with 52 women leaders who contributed. And we did that successfully. And this made news in all media in the region. And after that, we said, okay, now we are going to do advocacy. We are going into advocacy because we cannot keep giving food. We do not have the money. And we organized, we started organizing what we call today the lamentation campaigns. That is the wailing women. We went onto the street. We cried in both regions. And we mandated Adasitet here to coordinate in the Northwest because I live in the Southwest. So we cried and we called for inclusive dialogue and we asked for the war to stop. We asked both parties to stop, and we showcased all the atrocities committed, and we told them enough is enough, that women are up and doing. And after that, we decided that we should not limit ourselves in the two regions. The people who make the decisions to go into war are in the capital city, in Yaounde. They are not in the Southwest nor in the Northwest. So we took the women from these two regions to the capital city. And we told the policymakers to come and hear our story. And so we had a press conference where we deliver our key message, and this went viral. All diplomatic missions learned about it, and they started getting interested because nobody was interested in what was going on. People were dying, and nobody was speaking out, you know. So people started speaking out, and after that, we embarked into informal lobbying and advocacy meeting with the government through the Prime Minister's office. We met the former Prime Minister and this current one. We talked to him, we gave him our position, and we decided that it will not end there. To show impartiality, we need to meet the leaders of the non-state armed groups. So this is something nobody will think of in my country. I decided that I'm leading a delegation of women in the United States to meet with those leaders, the dreaded leaders, who nobody dare meet or speak to. Let them tell us, the women, what the problem is, that they won't allow our children go to school, and they keep allowing the military to kill our husbands, our brothers, our children, our sisters, while they themselves, their restoration forces, are committing atrocities, burying women alive. Yes, beheading military and doing all sorts of atrocities. We saw military take a child and throw in a big container of boiled oil. So this is terrible. A woman who was going to bury her husband and who was full-fledged pregnant got killed because the only crime she committed was to go and give the last respect to her husband. Many of such killings happened. Just last week, they buried a young girl alive. And so we met the leaders finally, who even were very surprised. But before meeting them, what did we do? We embarked on a broad-based media campaign, both at local, national, and then even on social media. We started publishing statements. Whenever there is an atrocity committed, we publish the statement. It became a routine in such a way that whenever we did not publish a statement, the diplomatic mission will start calling and asking that what's happening, we rely on you. Please, can you publish a statement? And we will do that. And once we did, we'll see the two parties agitating. We'll start getting threats from left or from right. Then we know that we are on track without taking side. So we started gathering momentum, making sure that we make our actions visible and known to both parties. And we impose ourselves to participate in one of the conferences of the non-state armed groups in the US. And when we went there, the government tagged us as the people, they called them back home AMBAS. So the government tagged us AMBAS, that this woman is supporting AMBAS. And we told the government, if you want this crisis to end, it's just a very young crisis. If you want this crisis to end, you started it in your minds. Allow the women to use their hearts in order to get it to an end, to bring it to an end. And that's so why will you see us as a threat? When we talk to the opposite side, when we are trying to reason with them, you know, to make sure that they come to reasoning. And so they started understanding, and they allow us carry on our actions. And finally, we just heard one day the head of state announcing that there will be a major national dialogue. And it was short notice. It took everyone unaware. But even though it took everyone unaware, we the women said, we must ensure that we are represented in that place because we know that we will not be invited. And finally, we started publishing statements and sending clarion calls, making the government to know that we are watching and that we are ready. In case we're not invited, they will see us on the street. And finally, they invited us for the pre-consultations talks with the Prime Minister at a very short notice. We organized ourselves and we went there with our position paper, suggesting, recommending what we think will make a good dialogue if these points were considered after making all analysis. And immediately after the pre-consultations, they said major national dialogue we hold in 4 days. Do you get what I'm saying? So nobody had the time to prepare. We're talking about a crisis that has taken so many lives and where there is stiff resistance from the restoration forces or the non-state armed groups. And nobody is taking time to prepare them, tell them how their safety, security will be if they come in the country, because they know that if they come, they will be killed or arrested. We are not sure of the environment where this will take place. Who is going to coordinate the discussions? And the head of state said, the prime minister. And we told him that, how can the prime minister be the coordinator of a dialogue for which he is one of the actors to the atrocities which are being committed? And so nobody listened. They just said 4 days after that we are going to the major national dialogue. And for the major national dialogue, the women were good for the launching. They gave us 10 invitations. And I was hospitalized. I was severely sick because of the threats, which I'm going to talk later on. But I told the women, you have to go to that place. And we will not only end at the launching. So they promised that we were going to be invited, and we knew we would be at the dialogue. So we saw 10 invitations. Little did we know that the invitations limited us only for the launching. And when the women got to the launching, they started calling me and say, these invitations are only for this 1.5-day launching. We are not allowed to go into the commissions where the real thing is happening. And I say, stay cool, stay put, follow our strategies, you attend the launching, and then storm the corridors. Yes. And immediately after the launching, they said they issued us 2 invitations, one in my name and another one in the name of one of my coordinators, regional coordinators for the Southwest. The rest, nothing of the 10 women who attended. And I told the women, storm the corridors. Make as if I was there. And everybody, those women stormed the corridors, and they didn't leave those women and the prime minister's office rest until they got 10 invitations to get into the various commissions. And so finally, they were on the table, even though So while in the commissions, they were the first to take the floor. Some became rapporteurs of commissions. They were giving me feedback and so on. In a nutshell, this is what happened. And I remember very well that when we went to the United States, the non-state armed groups leaders look at me and ask me, are you normal? We've been trying you ever since. We've been observing and we've been watching. But you stay calm and you could move us to talk for 4 hours and a half in a closed room, only the 3 of us and the leaders, no one else. For 4 hours and a half, what will become of you when you go home? They're going to kill you. Now we truly believe that you women are the solution. We count on you. But we will not just make you think that you got it on a platter of gold. We won't say yes, yes to your request. When we go to Geneva, that is where we are going to take what you submitted as request priority number one. And I say, oh, that's good. I didn't show my happiness in front of those men. I didn't want them to think that we were happy that we were making some major strides, you know. Immediately we left that hall, other progressive leaders started calling us that you've had a meeting with the radicals. We also want you to have a meeting with us. And we were leaving the next day. So we had to do something, and we told them, okay, we're going to have a meeting with you through Zoom. And we had a Zoom meeting for 2 hours and a half, and it wasn't an easy one. So brief, this is what we've been able to do for the past 13 months.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So just a few things I'm going to pick up. So on the one hand, what's amazing about everybody here and the 20 years that I've been doing this work, including actually at the global level, we don't wait for people to open doors for us. In fact, we don't even wait for the door. We just like bang through the walls, right? Is there something about the need to just get on and do something, which I think is really extraordinary in terms of the work of women peacebuilders. The other thing which is interesting is that so often one of the ways that they try to kind of diminish or discredit is by saying, oh, this is a Western agenda, these are Western ideas and so forth. And yet all of you talked about using cultural norms and, you know, whether it's the traditional practices or others or, you know, so lamentations and others. It's you're actually using the power of women and women as a sort of within their gender roles in your societies, but turning it around on the men, which is fascinating. My question, and I'll come to Barbara first, is when we think about women peacebuilders and women mediators, so often I'm told, but you know, you're being essentialist. You know, women and peace, you're being essentialist. And I turn around to them and I say, actually, this is the most dangerous work that anybody can do. And it's not all women who do it. It's very specific women who become peacebuilders because it's dangerous. So in terms of the threats and the risks that you take, can you explain a little bit? And I'd love to just hear from everybody. And then the second part of the question is, what gives you your strength? When we think, the other question I often get is, who are they? You know, what's their legitimacy? And my response always is, well, what's the legitimacy of the armed groups? You know, just because they have guns doesn't mean that they're legitimate. So legitimacy is a issue that we need to talk about. But what, when you go in and you're in these spaces, what is it that gives you your strength to know you're doing something right and it's not just, you're not on your own? So you start, Barbara.
Listening to you, what came to mind is when we had the rebel war, we had peace, and then the rebels came into Freetown, which is the capital. Before it was like, yes, we're hearing something, but it didn't exist. And then they came into Freetown. You'd be surprised to know that the men hid under the beds, and I mean it literally, and it was the women who were visible. They had to go out to search for food to feed their families. They had to protect the men, and I think to a certain extent they were seen as not being as threatening as the men. Because when the rebels found the men, in most cases they were killed. In most cases, especially when they came into Freetown, they were very angry. So for me, if we could protect, and I'm talking even myself, because my husband at the time, my first husband, was a government minister. So he had to go into hiding. And I had to come out, take food to ensure that everybody at home had food, that sort of thing. So for me, if we could do it, if we could face the rebels, and for me, the worst people you could think of were the rebels. If we could face them, if we could protect our families, what else can't we do? And for me, because of my work with women and the horrors that they went through, it wasn't a matter of my personal safety and security. It had to be done. And I also realized that we were very, very powerful. We had a coup, and the soldiers were called sobels because they were soldiers during the day and rebels at night. So the people didn't trust them. So the military that took over didn't want elections. We were calling for elections. They didn't want elections. They said they wanted peace before elections. So we wore black, and we went. We had what we call the Bintumani Conference 3 to say we want elections. The place was so tense, you could cut it with a knife. It was really, really tense. I mean, imagine the soldiers armed soldiers inside the hall. They had done checkpoints all over, you know, the route coming to where we're having the conference. My husband was attacked. He was brutalized. I didn't know I was in there. When I got to the hospital, when I finally got to the hospital, he was so angry with me, because I had insisted that you have mobilized your people to come. So you have to come as the leader. And because I left home very early in the morning, I was strategic, clever, and he decided, you know, it's true.
So I left, I got there at 6 in the morning, and I sent him a message that everybody's here, you have to come. Unfortunately, he came to the meeting when the tension was high. The soldiers, they were really, really angry, and they brutalized him. But it was very, very tense. But I realized at that time that the fact that we were women, we were powerful, but like we were talking before we came on, they couldn't touch us. They couldn't. Like in other countries where it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman, we us, they couldn't. So we slowly were realizing how powerful we were. And for me, all of these experiences gave me strength to go on. And the fact that our community women who do not have access, the access that we had, were looking up to us to change their lives because we were relatively privileged, it gave you the strength to go on. And that's what we've carried on, you know, in all the work that we have done. In terms of legitimacy, I always say I don't think people should ask me about legitimacy because we don't ask the men about legitimacy. They don't ask the women. It's true. They don't ask them when they're raping them, they're doing all sorts of bad things to them. As far as I'm concerned, I am a woman. I represent women. I'm a women's leader. I'm a Sierra Leonean. That makes me legitimate. I'm a peace builder. I have a right to be there. So that is my legitimacy. And I'm answering it because I'm here and we're talking about it. Otherwise, I wouldn't answer.
Thank you. Thank you. That's great. Isabel, can threats and also, I mean, right now for you, the kind of work that you're doing, and again, your sense of what gives you the strength to keep going and that sense of knowing that what you're doing is right?
See, the intervention that I shared with you all is not... It may sound very easy, but it wasn't. The road leading to where we are today, where we are, women are part of that gathering where we are releasing Adnikanama, and they are very proudly holding those in their hands, and they are part of that group. It's been a long journey where we have faced all kinds of threats also. We have faced them, braved them, and found other ways of dealing with it without making it seem very... difficult, because we were very conscious that we are dealing with a very sensitive topic, very sensitive issue, and we should not, nobody should feel threatened, nobody should feel that we have got into something that we shouldn't be there. We were only talking about those women, we were talking about their rights, we were only talking about, their right to choice, their right to live a dignified life. So around those issues, we approached the invisible actors as well, who may have created some hindrance or problem in for us to move forward. So we did a lot of advocacy. We created a lot of, we shared a lot of information. We kept all the doors and windows open when we would hold these meetings so that anybody was free to come and listen to what was being shared, so that, people don't feel that there's some kind of something else that's going on and something else. We would publicize, after the completion of the meetings, we would publicize in the local media about the outcomes of the interactions that we had, where we had representation from the society as well. So it was not that just us, and we were very conscious about who we were involving in those meetings, so that people would feel that they are part of the process. So when eventually we reached a stage where the consensus statement was issued, there was a wide acceptance for this kind of a decision. So we have people all across board, appreciating the fact that they did not feel left out because they felt they were part of the process. And I think that was a very key strategic thinking that went into the background of involving people, involving all stakeholders, so that they feel involved in the process.
Thank you. That's really it's so important, because again, in the sort of conventional wisdom, these talks are meant to happen exclusively and behind closed doors, and it actually does not do anything for confidence building at a wider public level. So that public question is really important. Rose, what about in Bougainville, as the five women, did you get threatened? Did you get, at what points did you feel that maybe you were touching vested interests that might not be happy having you there, especially given the copper and the natural resource dimensions? Mm.
At the community level that we were working in, because we had all, the first thing that I always do as a PSP leader is I develop relationship. Mm-hmm. When I develop relationship, that is my strength. And what gives me strength to do what I do is that I convince myself that I'm a bougainvillean and I have the right to live a fair life. And my people have a right to live a fair life, no matter what people say, no matter what the government says about me, no matter what UN says about me. I'm a bougainvillean. I have the freedom and I have the right to live a fair life. So that's my strength always in all that I do. So the first thing that I do doing intervention is I develop relationships. And to cross work with war infection is the most risky part of peace building. But when we develop relationship and we maintain it, and the people, the veterans have trust in us, that's when we can maneuver in and around them in negotiating and mediating for peace and reconciliation. So, my sister I was mentioning, normally the men use their mind to start a war. The women use their heart to end the war. So I think this is really fundamental for any one of us to know that peace building is about the heart of women. Peace building is about the heart of women. It's not about the mind of men. So men will always fight, and women will always broke a peace because of the heart that we have for women. And I think that's what continues to empower us to do what we do. Like currently, we have a situation in my community that we need to reconcile. So while we are working on the dialogue and the mediation, another group is just sprung up, and so I started building relationship again with a new group. So when I go back, I will be talking with the whole group to try and find commonalities of the purpose for Bougainville going into a referendum vote and the aspiration of the people of Bougainville to become an independent nation. So many times when people who are at war think, they don't think nation building, they don't think nationhood, because their mind is all distorted by their violence and the way that they see and I think it's the way that they see ending violence through violent means. And women see ending violence through peaceful means. So this is the difference that I find in women's participation in peace building compared to men's participation in peace building. So what I really want to emphasize here is I think the women that do peace building work have a lot of heart for their nation in the first place and their people. So many times during the process, we develop qualities that can sustain us, qualities like having patience, being determined, and being able to persuade people in difficult situations. So the qualities of individual peace builders play out really well when we are negotiating and mediating for reconciliations.
It's interesting because in the international processes I've been, they always talk about power sharing, and I sometimes think that it's the men are there, or the political and military leaders that we see are there and they care for power, mm-hmm. and the women are powered by caring. It's often we don't even have, you know, you don't have the resources. You just care so much that you're out there. It's quite something. It's Esther. So, Cameroon, threats and credibility for you. Like, what kind of threats have you faced, and what keeps you going, or what gives you your sense of legitimacy? Is it similar in terms of feeling representative? Is it, what is it that you've experienced there?
Talking about threats and credibility, I will first of all say that I've been subject to so many threats, not only I alone, but most of the frontline leaders have been subject to threats. Immediately, I was invited at the UN Security Council Area Formula meeting last May to speak about the humanitarian crisis in Cameroon, which was not well known to the world. As soon as I came out of that place, because I did not mention independence, because I did not call the name Ambazonia, I started receiving threats. I started receiving serious threats. And I asked myself, what crime did I commit to stay neutral in my speech? What crime did I commit as a woman to talk about the atrocities perpetrated on women and on children? And then I asked myself, who gave these men the right to threaten me over my voice and my life? And I started calling them just the way they started calling me. And I told the leaders, right still there in New York, that my voice is my right. My life is my right. We do not know who gave you permission or authority to think that it is only men who should discuss the crisis. And after that, my two children were kidnapped. Yeah? And I remember during that period, they were beheading people, killing, and they sent me a message that I have two girls and one son, that they are going to behead my son. And they chopped off the limbs of some people who had been kidnapped before my children, and asked the people to eat to death. And my children were horrified. They came twice in my house, held me and my family hostage at gunpoint, and took away everything. And all this while, my face has been on social media with the cross, all sort of threats, audio recordings, video, pictures, SMS on my phone, on WhatsApp. My staff, my collaborators have started receiving all those threats, asking them to resign so that the organization will crumble, and thereby I'll become helpless. They told me, we're going to kill your husband, and we are going to kill your children. And I told them, my voice, my right. My life, my right. When I was taking the women to the pre-consultations, they sent gunmen. But, you know, I outsmarted them because I knew that this would happen. I went and stayed in another town, in the economic capital, and I told the women, you meet me, we are going to meet in Yaoundé for the pre-consultations. They must hear our voices. Because they didn't want us to speak. Because they didn't want us to say those things that we've been seeing and which we know. We went and we stayed impartial. We stayed focused, strong-willed, staying within our narratives. We knew our narrative. We know, even right up to now, the narrative. We stay within the narrative. Fair and impartial in judgment in whatsoever thing we do. Because they could not succeed, they started framing me up. The next thing, I started hearing all over,
They sent that to diplomatic missions, to the UN and to everybody, that she is into politics, and they called the name of the National Political Party, the party in power, that she is a CPDM member, and that she's been parading the corridors of Congress to talk about federation and decentralization, whereas we want independence. And she is not one of us. Why should she talk? Unfortunately for them, I'm 100% civil society to the core for the past 25 years. And most of my partners know that. I've never been into partisan politics. Unfortunately for them, I have a track record that wherever I go, I speak on behalf of women and children and nothing else. We know our narrative. Unfortunately for them, they keep telling people that I am not from the Southwest, but I am from the Southwest. So our credibility stems from the fact that we know our narrative. We stay focused. We are fair and impartial in what we do. And we have the mandate of the grassroots women whom we represent. That is why when I was going to the UN Security Council Area Formula meeting, I made sure that the voices of women were reflected in my presentation. And that is why, before going to the major national dialogue, I made sure that all the women leaders, because these are women leaders leading organizations working with grassroots women, it means I will represent a certain constituency, which is that of grassroots. And these women were consulted, and their opinions were taken into consideration. And these were put together, and we submitted. That is what gives our credibility. Now, what makes me to continue? I had to pipe down a little bit, because I told the women that from nowhere to the major national dialogue is a big achievement for me. And I will call that the phase one of SNOT. I will end my mandate as your leader for this phase one. Let someone else take the phase two, and let us see. So right now, I'm the honorary president and vision bearer of SNOT, and there is another general coordinator. But what keeps us going is that everyday women are being killed, children are being killed, atrocities are being committed in our communities for that which we did not bargain for, because of men's greed and self-centeredness, because of political gains and the politics of the belly and pocket. We, the women, we are not part of it, and we do not want to be part of it. That is what keeps me going. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes for questions, comments, thoughts. We can probably go a little bit, maybe 5 minutes over as well. Keep them short so that we can come back. I'll collect a few and I'll come back to the panel for final comments. Anyone want to start? Anybody out there? Yeah.
Thanks very much for the brilliant presentations and speeches. I'm just wondering whether you get support from other civil society organizations, or what kind of collaborations you're actively seeking.
Thank you. Any other questions? This one was about getting support from other civil society organizations and collaborations. Yes, one over there.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for the presentation. It was really amazing. I actually don't have a question. I have a comment. It came up from all of you as you were speaking, how you speak about the resilience of women in local communities. And I just want to say today that your resilience as women leaders has shone through your very actions in trying to mobilize women to speak up for their own peace in their own societies.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Anyone? No, you're all being shy. Huh? Oh, yes. Yeah, go ahead. Kashmir question, and then one over there as well. Thank you. And please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Neelam Raina. I am an associate professor at Middlesex University. My question to Azabir is, we've understood the threats you faced as you're trying to touch a very sensitive topic. How does the changed circumstance of Kashmir affect you? And the generic question behind that is, you all live in spaces and work in spaces that are extremely volatile. You don't know what will happen in 48 hours. What are your first two key coping mechanisms in a shifting place?
Thank you. And then finally.
Thank you very much. My name is Florence from Kenya, and I really want to commend the team up here for sharing with us your experiences and affirming some of the work that we are also doing. I think for me, and this is a question that I keep grappling with as a woman peace builder, and that's the fact that many of the work that we do, and it's really good to have you, having been a former minister, some of the peace work that we do, or mediation work as insider mediators, is embedded in political realities. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the question is, given that when you're present, even at a mediation space, or when you're pushing for peace and stability, we're also having to grapple with the whole issue of politics dynamics, power sharing, how do we help transform that pocket and power selfishness that we see at the table to see the bigger picture of the citizens and what their needs are, and how to have that balance between, this is a political process, but we as women are looking at the larger picture of what is needed for every citizen in the land. So, embedded in political processes, how do we change that dynamic?
Thank you. And just while we're coming back to the, there's another one. Just a quick answer for you. I was the mediation on the standby team for the UN as their first gender and inclusion advisor. Went to Somalia, and it was in the middle of a famine, and it was exactly this. They were negotiating politics and power. And I said, but we should change the language. We have to go from talking about power sharing to responsibility sharing. Because if you're in the middle of a war, in the middle of a famine, and you want to be Minister of Finance, you better have an answer for how you're going to get food and water to people. But if we continue to talk about it as power sharing, then power is for them. And we're actually at an international, with our language, we are enabling them to not take responsibility for their citizens. But I think this is something that comes from women peacebuilders across the world in the years that I've worked. And so vocabulary also matters. Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Hannah from the Gambia. I want to congratulate the speakers. It was very interesting sharing your experiences. My question is that in all of your presentations, we found that you have been reactive to what is happening in the situation. What strategies do you think should be put in place for future proactive engagement?
Thank you. Thank you. So we have a bunch of questions. Proactive engagement, what other civil society support you get. Final comments from you know, we'll start with you. Yeah, we'll just go down the line. Thank you.
Let me answer Neelam. I think it was a direct question that you addressed to me. So how does it affect me? I live in the midst of it. I'm living in the eye of the storm. But I don't have to be a half widow to know what it takes to be there. Similarly, I don't have to be the Pandit migrant woman living in the camp or the lady living near the line of control. I am aware of the situation that I'm living in. I'm conscious of all the pain and suffering that women are going through. So we are trying to devise strategies to address some of the issues. We can't deal with everything. But whatever, wherever we feel that we can make some small difference in someone's life, we are trying. We are trying to strategize. We are trying to look for ways and support and means to address those within the existing systems. In the case of half widows, we address their issue of remarriage, their issue of property rights within the existing system of jurisprudence. We could not get back their missing husbands. We never claimed to do so. But whatever problems they were going through, we tried to address those within the existing systems that are in place. Similarly, the divides that had been created by the exodus, by the between the two communities, we've tried to bridge that. We have tried to bring women from both the communities of Muslims and Pandits together, so that they understand the pain of
of being impacted by the conflict. Because, you know, through my work, I found that it's very easy to work with women. Women connect to each other as mothers, as sisters, as daughters, mainly as women, women who have suffered. And they feel that, you know, they feel for each other. They rise above the local politics that goes into place.
Thank you.
I'd like to respond to Hannah's question because it's very interesting. For us, in terms of being proactive, it's ensuring that early warning systems are in place. In Sierra Leone, like with a lot of African countries, women are like custodians of the communities. They're there, they know what's happening, they know the dynamics, they know if strangers come in. So they know a lot of things that are happening. And this is something that we use in the Women's Situation Room for Peaceful Elections, and it has worked. So we set up, we have early warning systems. We build the capacity to ensure that they work. We work with, we do a lot of collaboration as well with other organizations working in these areas. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to look for funding to say, I want to set up structures. You work with the existing structures of partners. We ensure we have access to the powers that be, but the powers that be, being political, are normally very dodgy. So what we do is we put pressure through our international community, like the ECOWAS. We say if there are things going on that we're concerned about, we always have access to somebody within the ECOWAS community. But also with our diplomatic community, our donors, sometimes are very, very useful in terms of ensuring that their investment in, like, Sierra Leone are protected. And one of the things that I firmly believe in is using the media, letting the public know, letting communities know that this is what is happening, and indirectly putting pressure on the government to respond and to react. So these are some of the strategies and things that we do.
Thank you. What proactive engagements have we done for Bougainville, because it's a post transition period now. And for me, I have been, you know, thinking about how to sustain the peace and stability that we have now. So recently I've come to realize that because the illiteracy rate is so high in Bougainville, so and many of the youths have not gone to school, and many of them have dropped out from grade 8 or grade 10. So I saw that opportunity to start building the capacity of the youths, especially the youths that did not see the conflict, the 10-year conflict. So the age group that I'm working on is an age group between 15 and 25. So my idea is to give these youths enough information and enough capacity so that if in an event that there is a conflict again, then we already have peace builders in the community that will help families to survive the conflict. So we started with a number of 14, and just before I came, we had a training for them, and we ended up having 36 participants of youths ranging from 15 to 25. So that's a strategy that I'm employing to guarantee the sustainability of the peace that we have currently, and because 2020 we will be electing a new government. So one of the things that Bougainville has to do now is to educate the people how to vote leaders. So among the peace building work training that we will be doing, we will be educating them how to choose a good leader as well. So leadership is one of the priorities that we will be training the youth on, because Youths in Bougainville represent 60% of the total population, so it's a majority population, and but I'm only piloting this idea in my constituency. If I see that this idea is successful, then I can move to other communities, like communities maybe in the southern region. And also we network with other civil society organizations. So through the networks, we will be sharing our ideas with other communities of how we have started building the capacity of the youth who we know will be in the forefront if anything happens in the post-transition period.
I'll talk about the first key coping mechanisms, which you talk about. The very first one will be that we are a coalition of many women. So the first coping mechanism is the support of the women of the network. And the second one is analyzing our immediate environment in terms of security concerns and take appropriate actions, knowing that we've built local, national partnerships, and this came as a result of WMC. I will not cease thanking them because of capacity building, which they provided us in mediation and peace building, and what it entails, what it takes to be a female mediator, and what the challenges are. So ahead of time, we already know what awaits us, and we prepare ourselves towards such and make sure that we take appropriate measures. But the question, I want to ask that question here, because we have human rights defenders in this hall, I believe. The question we often ask is that we are frontline leaders, female mediators, who have been working, who takes care of us, who stands in between our gaps to talk on our behalf, who provides us the support and protection which we need. Twice, my children, I was attacked at gunpoint, my children were kidnapped. Where are they? Who will speak for us, if not ourselves, in our very little way, little knowledge and skills which we have? And that is why coming here and getting all what I'm getting as exposure by WMC matters a lot, because if I could influence and engage the non-state armed groups and go up to the dialogue, it is because of the knowledge and skills which they gave me in mediation and peace building, and which we hope many other women will also benefit. Her husband was kidnapped. Her husband has been kidnapped. And right now, as we speak, he is in coma in the hospital. So who takes care of us? Who gives us that care which we need? We want human rights defenders who are in this hall to think about that. How do we change the dynamics of pocket policies? I would say we find ourselves where we are today because of poor governance, bad governance. Give me good governance and everything takes its place. This is what we need in our country. So our capacities must be brought up. We must be empowered to be able to do winning advocacy for better policies, which considers the needs and interests of everyone in the country. We must think of empowering women, bringing them to leadership position so that they could also influence or cause the change. this is what I believe about that. I think my sisters have already provided answers for.
Thank you, and so great. I'm going to take the chair's prerogative very quickly because it's a great segue to a campaign that we are launching through ICANN and WASD, which is hashtag Stand With Women Peacebuilders. And it's precisely about this issue of not only legal and political recognition and support and enabling, but also financial support. We've started a fund. We know how to get money down to the ground. We know the need for protection, and so we really want to elevate this issue in terms of protecting our peace builders. And then we've understood over the years that actually it's so important for the public to understand what it is that peace builders do, because it is very specific work. It's very different in many ways to some more traditional development and human rights work. This issue of relationship building and willing to go out for dialogue with armed actors and expose yourselves. These are the specific unique characteristics, and it's time that the world knew more about you. So with that, I want to thank the panel. It was really a pleasure to hear the conversation. I want to thank our colleagues at the LSE and Zoe for coordinating, colleagues at Conciliation Resources and the Women's Commonwealth Women Mediator Network. Rahman is here, and Jonathan, others who brought us all here together, and hope that we have more of these kinds of sessions moving forward through 2020. And next time, each of you just bring one of your brothers, fathers, husbands, lecturers. They might learn something. So thank you very much. Bye.